10:15 a.m., and you're listening to WLUW Chicago Sound Alliance broadcasting live from the campus of Loyola. And this is the Logic Consortium. And today we're here with immigration attorney Daniel Toman. And we're going to be talking about, again, immigration law and policy and the recent ongoing, some exciting things that Daniel has proposed. First of all, Daniel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so how will you speak into the mic again, Dan, if you can. Let's see. Oh, there we go. Let's make sure we're live.
How about now?
Now is great. All right. Let's bring that one down for you. Thanks so much, Dan, for joining us. As I said, this is the Logic Consortium. My name's Jake Briskman, also known as Briskovich, and we're here talking about immigration law, and we're taking all calls, 773-508-WLUW. We did get a caller last week with our guest, Alexandra Falindra. And today I wanted to start with kind of the recent big announcements that happened. Obviously, last week there was the rollout of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Isn't that correct?
That's correct, Jake.
And so basically on August 15th, people began to be allowed to apply for this temporary 2-year reprieve from deportation where they could work during it. Who are these people that can apply for this deferred action status?
Well, Jake, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, as the name suggests, is aimed at people who came here as children, who were brought here when they were young. You've got to be under the age of 31. You've got to be, in most circumstances, 15 or older. You have to show that you've been in the U.S. for 5 years continuously and that you came here before the age of 16. There's actually a lot of confusion out there as far as deferred action versus the DREAM Act, which is a legislation that has been proposed numerous times in Congress, getting as far as a majority in the Senate, but then failing on procedural grounds. I think a lot of the reason for the confusion is that the population that benefits from deferred action is by design a lot of the same people who would have benefited from the DREAM Act. So in introducing deferred action, it was presented as something that would benefit those same people who would have been eligible for the DREAM Act had it become law. And somewhere along the way, the had it become law got dropped off, and as it gets reported and repeated and passed along, people think that this is a DREAM Act, which, as you know, it's not.
Right. And so to be clear, this is not the DREAM Act. While it applies to similar population that the DREAM Act was directed toward, this is not a pathway to legalization. This is a temporary 2-year benefit that somebody can apply for and maybe renew after those 2 years.
That's correct. And it is a significant benefit. It's something that allows for many young people who are living in the United States, and this is all they know, it allows them things such as getting a driver's license because they'll be able to attain work authorization, which they can then use to obtain a Social Security number. The importance of that is huge, because the number of people that come into contact with law enforcement, people in certain immigrant communities in particular, as a result of not being able to get a license, is significant. And by allowing people safety from that, it's providing a very tangible and very significant benefit to a lot of people.
And as we know, a lot of people lined up for that benefit. There was that huge event on August 15th, I believe, at Navy Pier, where Congressman Gutierrez and Senator Dick Durbin appeared, and you were there, in fact. Can you tell us what went on that day and what was happening?
Absolutely. The event was hosted by various entities, notably the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, and then there were numerous dignitaries. Mayor Rahm Emanuel was there. A lot of people showed up. There was an event, basically recognizing the contributions of the young people in the room. A number of attorneys were there from the American Immigration Lawyers Association and just a number of other groups to do legal screening. Numerous non-attorney volunteers were there as well to try to organize people. The way this was set up was similar to, to many other workshops for immigration benefits, where you basically have an assembly line sort of system, and you have some screening to put people into the right path, and then different people do different parts of the process. Due to the frankly staggering response, the number of people that showed up, Some of whom were registered, some were not registered in advance, as had been requested. It was a bit overwhelming, and you know, I was only one part in the process. I didn't have an outside view of the whole overall experience. I know some people were frustrated, you know, volunteers and attendees, but people were, at least the people I interacted with, were generally cognizant of the fact that this is something, you know, we're all trying to do something good here. We're all on the same page, you know, and people were generally good and patient. And, you know, there are going to be other events like it. It's definitely a learning experience, and each subsequent event should be smoother than the last.
So to be clear, there will be more screening events put on by the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, ICIRR. And they can go to the ICIRR webpage to see future workshops and events where people can be screened for this deferred action for childhood arrival benefit?
That's my understanding, yes. ICIRR has a page dedicated to Dream Relief, which I believe it's dreamrelief.org. And that's it's either them or an affiliated group, but it's a page that's a kind of a clearinghouse for information about deferred action for childhood arrivals, and information would definitely be posted on there as far as subsequent events.
So let me just announce, this is the Logic Consortium, WLUW Chicago. We're live in the studio speaking with immigration attorney and immigration policy guru Daniel Tolman. And we're taking all calls at 773-508-WLUW. And we just spoke about the recent big news. President Obama announced something on June 15th, his administration, that there would be this deferred action status for childhood arrivals. And we kind of talked about how it was rolled out on August 15th. And Daniel actually attended the huge event that got so much press. I heard there were over 10,000 potential applicants there.
I haven't seen official numbers, but I believe it. That sounds consistent with what I saw. I mean, just a line, you know, stretching from, you know, where you get dropped off by the buses and trolleys at Navy Pier all the way to the back to the Grand Ballroom at the very far end of the pier.
So we're taking all calls, whether it be in with respect to the deferred action status for childhood arrivals or anything else surrounding immigration law and policy at 773-508-WLUW. And I really wanted to jump into the proposal that you've really been the impetus behind here in Springfield. There's a proposal that you've helped craft that would give some type of relief to certain people imprisoned in the penitentiary by immigration. Can you tell us all about it, Daniel?
Absolutely. What you're referring to is a House Bill 5750, which was introduced in February by a Representative LaShawn Ford. This bill began as a work by the Chicago Bar Association Human Rights Committee. Royal Berg, a fellow immigration attorney, and Andrew Schott, co-chairs of that committee, asked me to work as legislative liaison and to work specifically on this proposal. So what we did at the CBA was put together some language to amend the Post-Conviction Hearing Act, as well as Section 1401 of the Illinois Code of Civil Procedure, relief from certain judgments after a number of years have passed. We introduced both proposals to the CBA Legislative Committee at large. The second proposal for Section 1401 is getting tweaked. There's some concerns that were expressed by different groups about, you know, what it could do to other judgments. But the first part, the Post-Conviction Hearing Act amendment, did get the endorsement of the CBA, as well as a number of other organizations as we moved it forward. And it was recommended for introduction at the state legislature, and that's what Representative Ford has done. I have spoken to Mr. Berg, and he has met with various individuals to discuss the status of the proposal. It's currently in a committee. As you know, the Springfield legislature is doing other things right now. But we are hopeful that in the coming months that this bill would move forward out of committee and possibly for a vote. What the bill does is it amends the Post-Conviction Hearing Act to allow people who are subject to being taken into custody by immigration authorities to raise certain challenges to criminal convictions that they may have in the past. So what happens right now is the Post-Conviction Hearing Act allows you to move to vacate a conviction for a crime that if you are somebody who is either in custody or subject to being taken into custody by state authorities, but that's where it ends. So what ends up happening is I don't know if you have discussed Padilla v. Kentucky, a Supreme Court decision that addressed basically the right of immigrant criminal defendants who are misadvised about the consequences of crimes to try to attack those convictions. It's a case where you have somebody who's, for example, a permanent resident, and he goes to court for a drug crime, and the attorney tells him, oh, it's just a misdemeanor, you're fine, nothing's going to happen with this. And then they learn later that it's actually a very serious, it's a deportable offense and can cause all kinds of problems, and they didn't know that's what they were pleading guilty to. So what happens is, that's a conviction that sometimes needs to be vacated. It's the only way to get relief from what happened. If you are on probation, or if you are in custody, in Illinois custody, you are able to raise that attack to say, wait a minute, I was told wrong. I listened to my lawyer lied to me, my lawyer was wrong, my lawyer didn't know. You're able to raise that through the Post-Conviction Hearing Act. But once you're done with all those things, you can't, as the law stands today. So the consequence is that, for example, if a lot of the people that are affected by this don't find out about the bad consequence until years later. Somebody might be a permanent resident who pled guilty to a drug crime or a gun crime or something, and then a few years later they want to try to get their citizenship, and when they're filling out the paperwork, they find out that that had a drastic consequence. What often happens is by then it's too late, because they finished their probation, they complied with everything, they paid the fines, it's been done for years. And there's nothing they can do right now to try to reopen that case and get that corrected and raise those issues. The way the law is right now, if you've got two people, say you've got two people that are, pleading guilty either to the same or similar, I guess not the same offense, but different offenses, one of them gets a 10-year sentence or an 8-year sentence in the penitentiary, and they get sent somewhere, downstate, and then somebody gets 2 years probation. 8 years later, they both find out, that this has a serious consequence. The person that's in the penitentiary can attack that conviction, but the person that finished their probation 6 years earlier can't. So we are proposing, or we're hoping that Representative Ford's bill will move forward. It would amend the Post-Conviction Hearing Act to allow people who are subject to being taken into custody by federal authorities, as well as state, as a result of a criminal conviction, to do so. And it's important to note, this doesn't mean that, these things get automatically reopened. It doesn't mean they get vacated. Vacating a criminal conviction is kind of a complicated process, and you need to have, a claim. You need to have a reason. You can't just go back and say, oh, I changed my mind. But in the cases we discussed where you were misadvised or not advised at all by an attorney, for example, about the consequences, then at least the court should hear those claims, and the court should at least determine, should we reopen this? Should we go back? Did you know what you were getting into? Because right now the court can't.
This is very interesting. Because as you mentioned, there's this Supreme Court case called Padilla v. Kentucky that really changed the whole landscape in terms of what a defense attorney's obligation is to a criminal defendant, an immigrant, non-citizen defendant who is about or contemplating pleading guilty to a charge. It kind of created this new obligation on defense attorneys to advise defendants of the potential immigration consequences of their plea of guilty. Is that not true?
Well,
it's close. Okay.
It's close. It gets the point across. I don't know so much that it created something new as recognized, a consequence. It recognized, something that's already there. There is, litigation across the nation, state by state. Different courts are treating it differently as to whether this created a new substantive right or whether it's just a new interpretation of something that already was there. But aside from that, you're right. It certainly recognizes the states, in no uncertain terms that where there is, a consequence, an attorney has to advise their client of that. And one thing that has happened in certain, legal challenges is that courts get tied up into whether something is a direct consequence of a crime or a collateral consequence of a crime, and, how that makes a difference as to whether they need to be advised. courts have held, for instance, that you do need to advise your client of direct consequences, but maybe not so much about collateral ones. You know, the issue with that, the Supreme Court, I think, you know, addressed it quite clearly by saying it doesn't matter whether it's direct or collateral or what. You know, it's a consequence. The two are tied together. You know, amendments to immigration law over the past 20 years have made it, you know, such that the two are just inextricably tied, and we shouldn't get lost in this whole thing about whether it's, you know, direct or collateral. Now, unfortunately, Illinois courts have taken the position in some cases that Padilla did not say then whether it's direct or collateral, so they still apply, you know, a different rule. And you know, I think some of those decisions are subject to challenge.
But as an immigration attorney, you see this in where somebody is in deportation proceedings or gets called to immigration court for deportation proceedings, removal proceedings. And on their piece of paper, it says you were convicted or you pled guilty to such and such crime on such and such day. And the client, the immigrant, non-citizen says, but I didn't know. I was never advised. I was told to plead guilty to this. I was told that it wouldn't have much of an effect. This is really what we're talking about here, whether someone later on can actually challenge that conviction, that plea of guilty, and whether they can reopen the case. And right now, only if you're subject to custody by the state of Illinois or in custody by the state of Illinois can you challenge it, not if you're in immigration custody. So, as you said, somebody finishes their probation, is detained by immigration for a conviction that they had a few years ago, they cannot say and go back to the criminal court to say, I didn't know that the consequences of my plea of guilty would be immigration custody.
Right, and you know, you've got Shawnee Correctional Center and Tri-County Detention Center in downstate Illinois are about 30 miles apart. One of them houses people in ICE custody, one does not. And you have a situation where, you know, the earlier example of somebody who gets 10 years versus somebody who gets 2 years of probation, you know, 8 years later, one of them is in the penitentiary, the other one is in ICE custody. Those people are, you know, in the same boat in just about every way, except that the one that got the longer sentence is actually still able to challenge his conviction because he is still under state custody.
Creates this odd result, arbitrary result, currently.
It certainly, you know, it strikes a lot of people as being unjust, and it certainly strikes a lot of people as being a perverse result in that we tend to associate lighter sentences with a societal, you know, need for, if you get a lighter sentence, if you get, you know, probation, if you get no jail time, if you get just go, you know, go to class, do this, whatever, we tend to think of that punishment as for something that maybe we don't think is as bad as for somebody who gets 2 years in prison. And this, you know, the effect of the law as it is right now is that somebody who gets what we perceive as the heavier sentence, somebody who gets incarcerated, ends up having more rights to challenge that than somebody who did something that maybe we don't think is that bad. And maybe that's why they got that lighter sentence. What happens is at the criminal proceeding, criminal attorneys, judges, you know, there is a lot of confusion about what the immigration consequences of criminal offenses can be, and it's a very complicated field of law. I mean, some things are very straightforward. You know, murder, I think everybody in any criminal context would know that that's going to have an immigration consequence. But then you get into areas where the differences might make a big difference as to whether, you know, if a person has been admitted to the country, if they have status, then they're going to be subject to removability charges on certain convictions. Whereas somebody who doesn't have any status at all, you know, maybe the conviction itself is not going to affect them directly because they're just going to be removable because they're here illegally. But then the conviction is going to have an effect in that maybe that person could apply for some relief from removal, and now they can't because of the conviction. So the attorney needs to basically look at each defendant and say, well, what is their situation? What is their goal going to be? Is their goal going to be to preserve eligibility for certain relief? Is their goal going to be to avoid deportability? You know, what is it that this person needs? And I think what Padilla does is say that the more that people are informed about what's going on, you know, what the consequences of each thing are for each particular defendant, the more that courts are able to, you know, to enter judgments that are better fitting for the parties. I would throw out, for example, the sometimes, you know, immigration law has effects that may be go against what we would expect. It could well be the case that, you know, there's an exemption, for instance, for certain consequences for certain small amounts of marijuana for personal possession. There can be a situation where if somebody is contemplating, for instance, a little bit of jail time for possession of paraphernalia, as opposed to, you know, if they're facing a little bit of time for possession of marijuana, as opposed to just, you know, probation for possession of paraphernalia, it may be the better deal to take the possession, you know, and do the little bit of jail time, because the consequence is actually not as bad. The paraphernalia is something relating to a controlled substance, whereas the marijuana possession specifically falls under an exemption. So certain people in a very specific set of facts would actually be better advised to do a little time and take one charge over probation and the other charge, even though society as a whole, people that are not familiar with the immigration law and the consequences might think that, you know, the paraphernalia with probation is a better deal because it just seems like it's got less to do with the drug.
So you need a good crimmigration attorney to navigate the landmines of pleading to any criminal offense.
That's correct, Jake.
Let me remind everybody, this is the Logic Consortium, WLUW Chicago. We're talking with immigration attorney Daniel Tolman just about House Bill 5750, which would amend the Illinois Post-Conviction Hearing Act and also 1401, challenging old convictions. So, Daniel, thanks so much for telling us about that. How's it going down there in terms of?
Well, we're optimistic. We're certainly working with partner organizations across the state to try to build support for this. So far, every legal organization has been, you know, receptive. I've talked to people at the ISBA. You know, they haven't done anything formal. They generally wait until things are further along in the process before they actually issue statements on that. But the Chicago Bar Association obviously proposed it. American Immigration Lawyers Association has endorsed it. The Hispanic Lawyers Association of Illinois has endorsed it. Essentially, you know, we are trying to build a broad base of support. This is just something that I think achieves a just result. And again, it's just about getting something in front of a judge. You know, it doesn't resolve the case. It doesn't mean you automatically win, but it at least lets the argument be heard.
Let me remind everybody, we're taking all calls at 773-508-WLUW. We were just talking about House Bill 5750, and before that we were talking about the deferred action for childhood arrivals. And
actually, Jake, I'm sorry, if I can cut in real quick.
Please.
Something like HB 5750 may actually, you know, affect people that would be applying for deferred action but can't because of a criminal conviction. You know, to the extent that that's the case, you know, it's a case-by-case thing because it actually could well be, you know, certain factors have to be in place for you to be able to raise an attack to a conviction. You know, no one, I don't think, is going to, if this is the only relief they have, maybe they can't really show, well, if I'd known then that in the future this was going to happen, I wouldn't have done it. That's a little bit removed. You know, but somebody who maybe is now finding out that this thing disqualifies them, that this thing has a consequence, you know. So somebody who pled guilty to something, you know, several years ago is now wanting to go and apply for this, and they're told at a workshop, you can't. You have this felony conviction that disqualifies you. You have this particular type of misdemeanor that disqualifies you. And aside from disqualifying you for deferred action, it has this other consequence, you know, and has always had this other consequence. It had this consequence when you pled guilty. You know, the person hears this and they say, well, I had no idea. Nobody told me. And a lot of them, you know, were never told. Their attorney didn't tell them, especially these deferred action. Excuse me. A lot of the kids that are eligible for deferred action are kids who, you know, unless you knew that they're foreign born, you may never think that. So even if a judge is going to give a warning that says, if you are not a U.S. citizen, you need to be aware that this can have a consequence, they may not think to give that warning to some of these kids because, you know, they grew up here. they've lived here their whole lives. They seem as American as you or I. And, you know, unless somebody says, hey, by the way, I'm not from here, the judicial system may not be on notice that they need to be told.
Very interesting. The connection between the proposal, House Bill 5750. And if people support, they can always call their local congressperson or state representative or state senator.
Both. We need everybody to pass this thing.
Right. So that is HB 5750, amendment to the Illinois Post-Conviction Hearing Act. And, you know, let me remind everybody, this is the Logic Consortium. We're speaking to immigration lawyer and policy man Daniel Toman about his proposal in Springfield, one of the proposals that he's behind, and also about the recent ongoings in immigration law and policy. And we're taking all calls at 773-508-WLUW. We haven't had a call today. We're very interested in anybody that wants to call to talk about this or anything else about immigration. I know we were talking about the economics and the history last week. And one thing that I did want to talk about is in June of 2011, President Obama's administration issued a memo that is now famously called the Morton Memo, where it kind of lays out the agency's enforcement priorities. And this has led to what a lot of people are referring to as prosecutorial discretion, where the administration kind of has, on its own initiative, reviewed a lot of the cases that are in immigration court, and they've said, if people do not meet with our criteria of what we see as high enforcement, and if there are other factors, if there are a lot of community ties, friends and relatives who are citizens or residents, we'd consider not giving them legal status, but dropping the immigration removal case. So that's been kind of the big buzz for the last 14 months or so, that everybody's talking about, is this person eligible for prosecutorial discretion? And immigration lawyers have been submitting requests to the federal prosecutors, the chief counsel's office of Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And so have we seen a big change, Dan, since this Morton memo? And has the government been dropping a lot of cases? And because I do still see people in deportation proceedings who've never been arrested even one time.
Well, what ends up happening is the Morton memo was probably expected by, you know, it was expected by a lot of people to have like a far-reaching effect, that it was going to be a clearing of a purge, you know, of the caseload that was pending before the courts. I think it's like 300,000 cases were pending at the time. And basically what was done with the memo was a procedure was set forth for DHS to evaluate all the cases on their docket and kind of make a case-by-case determination of whom they thought this was appropriate for. What the numbers have shown, and I apologize, I don't recall who looked at the numbers, but I know that an organization released some numbers recently that were a bit disheartening. They showed a very, very low percentage of cases actually being cleared in this way. Now, what basically, you know, you do see cases of people that have never had a law enforcement contact. A lot of times these are cases of people that apply for a benefit they don't qualify for, or things like that, or somebody that was, you know, in a work enforcement type scenario. It's unfortunate to see those cases, you know, from my personal perspective. And as far as how the agency makes a determination as to which cases they're going to go forward or not, I think the Morton memo does more than just address people that are pending in court. I think that it does give some guidance to you know, how the various enforcement arms act and operate. And I think perhaps some of the good that the memo has done is, you know, in areas that we don't see, is maybe, you know, in some of the cases that are not being put into proceedings as opposed to the ones that are, how they make the decision of whom to go after and whom not to. It could be, you know, used in attorneys, you know, are creative in how they cite the memo, but it didn't really create prosecutorial discretion. It just provided certain guidelines by which it would be exercised. Another thing it did is sort of act as a precursor to the deferred action, because deferred action for childhood arrivals is every bit, you know, Secretary Napolitano states in the memo that she issued with regard to deferred action, that it is an exercise of prosecutorial discretion that makes that possible. So I think that what the Morton memo did was lay out criteria that then, you know, are able to be built upon for things like deferred action. But I agree that, you know, it has not had, I think that, you know, some various DHS offices are taking the position that, for instance, if you've had, you know, any criminal conviction at all, you're disqualified, whether it be, you know, driving without a license or whatever the case may be. And I think that, personally, I think that that's contrary to the intention of the memo. I think the, you know, the intent of it is to maybe clear some of those cases. But of course, you know, they're an agency that is going to apply their own criteria and follow their own memoranda in the way that they see fit. I can respect that. But it is frustrating that it hasn't had as far-reaching an effect as many had hoped.
So to be clear, I mean, there are estimates that there are 10 to 12 million people in this country, or a little bit more potentially, without papers. And President Obama has actually increased the deportation numbers since President Bush. There's a kind of a number around 400,000 that I believe is the agency and the administration's goal to remove each year from the country. So while he's talking about, and so he's basically said, we're going to increase the number of removals, but we're only going to go after the people of who've had convictions and are quote-unquote of high enforcement priority. So President Obama is kind of doing both sides. He's doing the deferred action, saying we're only going after people who have had criminal contact, but we're gonna try to get more people out of here. So it's kind of, he wants to maybe set up for future immigration reform. He wants to please the people on one side, saying, okay, we're increasing the deportations. Then it also goes in with this rhetoric about more boots on the ground on the border. And then secondly, but we're doing it from a more humane side. So is that what it is? Is it more humane? Is it because the numbers are up in terms of the deportations, more than Bush, is what the numbers say.
Right. The numbers are up, and I mean, to begin with, I think one big difference in the way that the Obama administration has approached this is when it comes to, you know, what are termed criminal aliens. It's just people who have committed crimes. What was happening under previous administrations is that they would report, you know, we've removed X number of criminal aliens, but it turned out that the crime was, you know, driving without a license or DUI or whatever the thing that they got, you know, just whatever put them into the system. Often it would be that somebody would get stopped driving without a license. They couldn't get a license. They're not eligible. They would just be pulled over for some, you know, suspicious reason. And by suspicious, I mean that the motive of the officer was suspicious, but somebody stopped. They had no license. They are issued a ticket for that. They go to court. They plead guilty. Has no consequence. But then there's an ICE hold, and they go into immigration custody. And then that person, because they were convicted of driving without a license, went into the column of criminal alien removed. And that was, you know, what a lot of the programs in predecessor administrations were being criticized for, is things like secured communities. You know, they would hype up the numbers of criminal aliens that they were targeting and removing. But a closer look at the numbers showed that the crimes that, you know, that were underneath these cases were actually usually low-level things that are not really what the program was intended to get. So, you know, you say we need to get rid of criminal aliens, and you cite, you know, violent offenses and drug crimes and things like that, and then you start going after people that broke traffic laws. That was something that I don't think is done as much now. On the flip side of the coin, you've got, you know, a lot more, as you said, high-priority cases are not necessarily things that we may consider so sinister or bad. You know, I know of people who many years ago pled guilty to some crime and, you know, and didn't think it was a big deal. People who would benefit from 5750. They got probation, they paid their fines, they've gone on with their lives, and they think everything is fine. They're a little surprised when I tell them, you know, ICE could come and get you. And then when you read in the paper about ICE rounded up, you know, 10,000 drug criminals this weekend, that was you. They're talking about you. You know, when they say people that are convicted of certain serious crimes, we hear the statistics, you know, about drug felonies and things like that, and we think of something a lot more serious than maybe a possession of a certain amount that just happens to be a felony. things that somebody can get probation for and just go along their way, and the state courts end up having a much more serious consequence in the immigration context. And what the Obama administration has done, I think, is focus more on those people that, you know, if nothing else, they do have those qualifying crimes. How we feel about those crimes is something different. How we view them is something different. But they do, you know, focus their attention away from people that just have the traffic stop to people that have been convicted of more serious things. So they have been more, you know, ramping up those numbers. I agree that I think that it does allow, you know, whether by design or not, it certainly gives the administration a little political cover when people start complaining about, no, we can't talk reform. We can't do, you know, it's going to be amnesty. We can't do this until we close the border. We can't do this until we deport, you know, all the criminals that are here. For every person that says, no, we can't until this, this administration is certainly providing, in my mind, providing an answer. Net immigration, I think I've seen numbers that is pretty much at zero as a combination of, you know, the economy and increased enforcement. So what happens is that when critics start saying we can't do immigration reform until we secure the border, this president is actually able to say, look, the border is more secure than it's ever been. You know, and if we're going to do something about the other people, then maybe this is the time. Again, whether it's intentional or not, the fact that he's deporting record numbers of people does give him, I think it gives him the ability to say to opponents of immigration reform that they cannot use, you know, the need for enforcement as a reason or an excuse to block any further reforms.
This whole concept, though, of securing the border, I believe, is a bit of misdirection and kind of creating emotion out of nothing. I mean, securing the border, people are still going to be able to come and go, no matter how many boots you put on the ground. In terms of, you know, there's the old saying, if you have a 10-foot fence, there can be a 12-foot ladder or whatever it is. And also, just going back to that, in terms of security, how many people, I know I mentioned this last or a couple of weeks ago, how many of the 9/11 criminals came over the border from Mexico? I believe zero.
And that's, you know, another thing that needs to be discussed. And when we think about immigration reform, and we think about immigration in general, is who do we think of as immigrants? And I think that there are a lot of perceptions that we have that are not always accurate. And those perceptions affect how we approach immigration law. People have the perception that it is possible to obtain status if you apply. People have the perception that there's a line that you can wait in and come in legally, where the reality is that under current immigration law, most people can't. You know, unless you have the right relative with the right petition or the right employer with the right petition, there's no line to stand in. So because people think that this process exists, it makes it, you know, in their mind, it makes sense that these people who are going outside the process are doing something wrong. You know, they don't see it as something like that's the only way to do it. People think about, like, well, my grandpa came legally, you know, but they don't realize, like, all grandpa did was show up, you know, at Ellis Island.
Right.
And they check him for lice, and they say, go wait 5 years and you'll be a citizen. That doesn't exist anymore. And in my mind, at least, you know, that person that risks everything they have, you know, we idolize the person who sold off all their belongings in Europe to buy a ticket to come here and make a life. That's what these people are doing that are coming from Mexico and Central America, you know, but the law has changed. So at the time that, you know, grandpa did this and came from Europe and you know, all he had to do was show up, whereas now that's not an option. And personally, I think that somebody with that spirit to sell off their belongings and just to make it, just to get over, I don't think that person is going to be deterred by, you know, they need a visa. I think if the laws had been different at the time, then, you know, grandpa would have come through Canada.
Hmm. Well, that's so important to put it in a historical context, as you just did, Dan. And I think we're going to be winding down here. Again, this is the Logic Consortium. Here we're with Daniel Tolman, immigration lawyer. And you can look at Daniel Tolman, tolmanlaw.com.
Yeah, the name is a little...
T-H-O-M-A-N-N.
Right.
Okay, and you can contact him anywhere if you have any questions. And it was so great to have you in the studio. Adam, I think we're going to wind down here. And, Dan, if anything else to add, feel free, or you're invited back any time. I wish we could get a caller next time. It was very exciting last week. But
I appreciate the chance to be on and talk about these issues and, you know, get some information out there. I'll certainly be back if you'll have me.
Of course, of course. And thanks so much. This is the Logic Consortium, and have a great day, everybody. Thank you.